Dan, how are you?
Welcome to Washington, D.C.
Loving it here very much. Looks like I know we only got a chance to briefly say hello as you were going one direction and I was going another last night at the White House lawn, but it looked like your family was enjoying themselves.
Oh, it's always a great time. It's one of the neat things about having the honor to serve here is that you get to watch the fireworks from the best piece of real estate in the country. So it was a fun night.
Yeah, it is. It's just amazing when you look around and realize that, you know, behind you is the White House and in front of you is fireworks and there's the Washington Memorial and there's the Jefferson Memorial and the ellipse and everything else.
Lots of history.
It sure is. Do you ever just sort of get lost in all that in the moment, or do you?
You know, I walked around this place for the first year thinking that somebody's going to come up behind me and tap me on the shoulder and say, "We figured you out, buddy. You're not supposed to be here." I mean, it really is. You have those pinch yourself moments, and despite the familiarity of working here for 6 years, you never take it for granted because it's a true honor.
It absolutely is. Well, nice to catch up with you. We appreciate the time this morning. I know it's a busy day, and much of that because of what's going on with the provocation from North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
What would you like to see come out of the UN today?
Well, it's important that we take a step back. In the last couple weeks was really the diplomatic groundwork had been laid for the eventuality of this type of provocation, as you described it. And that is to make sure that the entire international community, and in particular our key partners in the region, are all speaking with one voice. And I think you've seen that in the last 12 hours, where everybody is coming out with condemnation of the launches that took place, or taking place, as the last one early this morning. But I don't want to prejudge exactly what's going to come out of this council. We're at high-level consultation. Secretary Rice also is talking with her counterparts. Steve Hadley, the National Security Advisor to the President, also having talks today with South Koreans. And we're going to work on this collectively because I think it's a very important signal to send to the North Koreans and to this government that we are speaking with one voice. So we're not going to race out in front of it on these consultations, but that's exactly what they'll be. But we do expect further condemnation by the international community. What this is a blatant disregard to the demands of the international world, message of telling them to come back to the table, have talks, and instead it's a further isolation of this very reclusive regime.
Why is it important that we do this through the six-party talks? I know, amazingly enough, a lot of the critics of the administration like to suggest multilateral talks in other parts of the world, but they want us to sit down mano a mano with North Korea. Why is that a bad idea, and why are the six-party talks, in your view, the preferred route?
Well, most people who study the issue of North Korea and in the region understand that a lot of the influence and changing of behavior that we want to take place can most be impacted by their neighbors, and China in particular, South Korea, the Russians, those who have equities in the discussion with North Korea. Also, as you know, we have already levied quite amount of sanctions on this North Korean government, but it's important also that there can't be loopholes or ways around that you could find in a bilateral negotiation, and that's why the President has felt it to be very important to have the actors who have influence on North Korea to be at the table. But you're right, the irony is when you hear the critics, and I think it's all motivated by just being against the President, on the one hand they argue against what they call unilateralism in decisions the President has made in the Middle East, yet we're being blamed for multilateralism against North Korea.
Yeah, well, it's they move the goalposts. That's a popular sport among critics of the administration, right?
Used to it though.
Exactly. and we've seen what happens in direct talks because really the Clinton administration was pretty much gamed by the North Korea regime, weren't they?
Well, that's a real concern, is that if this has been a regime who's not made the strategic choice that they want to give up their weapons, and what you fear is a sense of setting up a some sort of fig leaf type of agreement in which behind the scenes they continue to buy time to build up their missile capabilities and their nuclear capabilities. And that's a real fear, that if you allow for them to pay lip service to these type of negotiations, that you'll find yourself in that position. And that's why having China and South Korea and others at the table will clearly demonstrate to the North Koreans that we mean business this time and we're all speaking with one voice. And that will achieve a different result. But the bottom line really is, a strategic choice has to be made by the North Korean government. They haven't made it yet. They didn't make it under the Clinton administration. They haven't made it to this point. And it's important we continue to impress upon them that they need to if they want to have any relationship with the rest of the world.
Our guest is Dan Bartlett, consular to the president. We're live at the White House today in the West Wing. Yesterday, the president, although we did get to see him last night, and obviously had a chance to celebrate his 60th birthday and have some friends and family around him, spent the majority of the day with the troops. Why was the president at Fort Bragg yesterday?
Well, as we celebrate our nation's birthday, it's important when we reflect upon the sacrifices that have been made over the course of our nation's history, that we also look forward in the sacrifices that are continuing to be made to protect the very freedoms we cherish and we celebrate every year. And this gave an opportunity for the president to personally go down there and thank so many of the, not only the troops themselves, but just as important, their families. And a lot of times the toll it takes is it falls harder on the families than it actually does on the troops themselves. So he had a great time. He had an opportunity to meet with some of our special forces down there, the Delta team and others, to thank them personally for the type of work that they're doing that is so critical in this, in the nature of the war we're fighting. And what he's always just reassured by, or what it does is it gives him a sense of why our country is so great, because we have so many unbelievable young men and women who are willing to put their own lives at risk to defend what we all cherish and sometimes take for granted.
Story in the New York Times yesterday, I guess, about one of our, I've actually renamed it the terrorist tip sheet now, but I don't know that this is a closely held secret, but they're fond of printing those. The CIA has closed a unit that was charged with finding Osama bin Laden. Is that a sign of progress, or is that... What do you make of that decision?
Well, I think it's important for people to understand that that unit was set up prior to 9/11, back in 1998, and this was a kind of a specialized unit just focused on tracking bin Laden. I think what it shows is the fact that the progress we're making in the war on terror is that we have not only gone after the terrorists, but we are systematically changing and reforming the very institutions in our government to conform ourselves to fighting the long war on terror. So the unit itself is now so fully ingrained and integrated within the intelligence community is that everybody is focused on all aspects of Al-Qaeda and bin Laden himself. But nobody should read that and think that there's any less emphasis being put on finding bin Laden. I know it's a top priority of this president, and it's definitely a top priority of this government.
But, I mean, we believe that three-quarters of the leadership of Al-Qaeda is no more, right? And last number I saw, which is a few months ago, some 5,000 members of Al-Qaeda either caught or captured. So we have had a fair amount of success, even though many of the critics don't give the president credit for that, correct?
Absolutely, and there's no question that they have had to adapt to our successes, and the way they have done that is some have argued that bin Laden gives more kind of propaganda as opposed to operational advice or direction to his movement. We have got him holed up pretty well, and the fact of the matter is that we're putting pressure on all elements of the Al-Qaeda organization, wherever it may, you know, rear its head. So it definitely is a reflection of success, and some want to argue that because we haven't found him particularly, that it's been a failure. Obviously, we want to get him, and we want to get Zawahiri as number two as well, and eventually we will. But it's also, we have to look at it from an operational standpoint of how effective they can be, and we feel that we've been quite successful at really getting at the heart of it, because you mentioned the very people, the three-quarters of the top leadership, they're the guys who are actually doing the work, actually executing the plans. So when we knock out a Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or people like him or a Zarqawi, as we most recently did, we're really, really hitting at the heart of the operation, and we're having good success.
One of the tools in doing that, of course, has been this surveillance network of the finances of the terrorists, which was recently revealed, top secret program in the New York Times. Bill Keller, who's the executive editor of the New York Times, said over the weekend that really this wasn't that big a secret anyway. Terrorists already knew about it, and suggests that the attack now on the New York Times is red meat for conservatives in an election year. What's your response to that?
We didn't. This was their decision, not ours. We went to every length possible to try to persuade them not to run it. Then I don't think they should be surprised at the type of blowback they're getting from the public and from the community at large for revealing this. And I was struck mostly by Mr. Keller's comments saying that we only gave a half-hearted attempt to persuade them not to. That is nothing but nothing could be closer to the truth. We had the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Treasury himself sitting in the room telling him not to do it. And the fact of the matter is, I think I would rather have the good judgment of terrorism experts making the judgment as to whether it's still a successful tour or not, not editor sitting in New York. And that's where we just have a fundamental disagreement with the New York Times. We are deeply disappointed that they ran this story, and it has made it harder for us to track the finances and made it harder for us to win the war on terror. That's just a simple fact.
A couple other quick things here. A story in the New York Times today about the president maybe shifting the stance on immigration and getting away from the comprehensive program. In other words, everything together, a guest worker program with stepped up border security. Is this story accurate?
I don't think it was a very accurate depiction of what Mike Pence and other people were talking about. I think everybody expects the president and members of both the House and the Senate to be talking about different ways to skin this cat. But the president's still for comprehensive reform and believes that it's the best way to solve this problem once and for all. What Mike Pence and other people are looking at is how can we do comprehensive reform but do it in a way that builds in the realities of implementation of a program. And so I don't think that was a very fair depiction of his plan or the way people are viewing this. I mean, you saw Senator Spector himself had some positive things to say about the Pence approach, and it's something that deserves a lot of scrutiny, but it hasn't changed the president's broader view that if we really want to solve this problem, if we want to have every component of this thing, both enforcement on the border, interior enforcement, as well as dealing with 11 to 12 million people who are already here, we got to address it in one piece of legislation. How that legislation is implemented is something we ought to be willing to talk about.
Final question for you. A lot of Democrats seem to think they're going to have some big-time victories in the midterm elections come November because of the president standing in the polls, and also a sense in recent weeks that the president has turned a corner. Should Democrats be wary of their strategy of big gains come November, do you believe? Are you confident that things look good for Republicans?
I've always been fascinated by Democrats' gleefulness in late spring or early summer of election cycles. We saw this in 02. We saw this in 04. John Kerry was going to beat the president. What they forget is that when it comes down to the stretch, and when the people tune in and say, okay, we got to make a choice, it's just that, it's a choice. And when we have a contest of ideas, it exposes the other side's lack of ideas, how to win the war on terror, how to prevail in Iraq, what we're going to do to keep this economy growing. And that's what it fundamentally comes down to, and that's why we continue to win, and that's why we're going to win in November.
Dan, great to catch up with you. Appreciate the time very much. Nice to see you last night, and always appreciate catching up with you when we come to the White House. Thanks
always so much. A pleasure, and you're always invited.
All right, take care, my friend.
Thanks, Scott.